Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Lessons learned. It's been a little more than a month since the missile alert. We're awaiting a report from General Kenneth Hara of the Department of Defense about what to do going forward. Today we sit down with guest panelists to address our readiness.
It's a panel discussion about disaster management with in-studio guest panelist Courtney Harrington, chair of the State Emergency Communications Committee. Joining us on the phone, former FEMA executive Joe LaFleur, who also served as Emergency Services Director of two states and is now with GP Strategies Corporate Crisis Program.
We also hear from Toby Claremont. It's his first interview since he stepped down as Executive Officer of the Emergency Management Agency. And we also talk with Carl Kim, head of the National Disaster Preparedness Training Center, about shortcomings in our system.
On Friday, February 16th, we'll pick up the conversation right after the news. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Our subject this morning is emergency management. What has the January 13th missile alert taught us? We're asking listeners to weigh in.
The numbers to call are 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from Neighbor Islands. Let us hear from you. And before we introduce our in-studio panel, Catherine and I spoke a little over an hour ago with Toby Claremont in his first interview since he stepped down as executive officer of the Emergency Management Agency. Toby, what do you see as the roots of the issue here, the emergency management issue going forward?
I think complacency, in a word. We live in a society, Hawaii, where we feel safe and secure overall. We don't see a lot of really bad things happening. So consequently, we don't invest in emergency management systems like we should.
What would it take to invest to an appropriate degree?
A very thorough, rigorous analysis of the threats, hazards, and then the resources and the processes it would take to respond to them. That's not what we're doing right now. You know, we tend to cycle between disasters and periods of not much happening, and that's what's dangerous for us.
We've had a couple of, I'm thinking of a tsunami alert many years ago where the tsunami didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of people all got out on the road and, drove around aimlessly, and then there wasn't a tsunami. And it seemed to breed a kind of cynicism about alerts. Is that part of what's happening with the public?
I don't know if it's cynicism about the alert. I think that we feel safe. We don't believe it's really going to happen. And when it does happen, it catches us. And that's what happened. Actually, January 13th was beyond awful. I mean, just unbelievable. But it should have and must wake us up to the reality that the hazard is real, the threat is real, and that each of us, you, me, our families, the people we work for, need to prepare adequately. And I think we caught, the event caught us, all of us, unprepared. And that's the bigger question, I think, because we don't believe these things are going to happen. We don't invest in these systems the way we should. And that's a recipe for future failure. This is not going to get fixed by reorganizing or asking people to leave their jobs or anything along those lines. It's going to happen when we realize that we're fortunate to live in a great place, a wonderful place, but we are in the most geographically isolated area in the world. Our resources are finite. The resources that would come to our aid from the U.S. mainland would be here and not in hours, but in days. And that for those first few hours or days, 72 hours, whatever, 14 days, whatever number you want to put to it, we are on our own, and we need to prepare more deliberately for that reality.
And we are awaiting the results of General Hara's report, assessing that incident and what we need to do going forward. What's your sense of how we should look at this report?
I have a lot of confidence in General Hara. He's a smart man, and I've worked with him. So I have a lot of confidence in him. I think that if he focused less on what happened and more on what we could do to overcome this complacency, that we prepare adequately, we organize appropriately, that we resource to the level that our population deserves, then it would be a good report. But if it focuses a lot on who did what and when, I'm not sure that's really constructive.
And can you give our listeners some sense of what's the bird's eye view of how we decided to go in this direction of preparing for a missile alert?
Well, I don't know that missile alert was the end point. I mean, we about a year ago, we were asked by the governor and General Logan to begin thinking about and preparing for a potential threat from North Korea. And that threat is a pretty big deal. One, it would be nuclear. And second, it involves a time frame that's really tight, 20 minutes from launch to impact. And we wanted to make sure, after talking with the experts on the mainland, that, you know, Lawrence Livermore, Department of Energy, and others, that you need to give the population 10 minutes. You know, you warn them, you got to give them 10 minutes to do something meaningful to protect their lives. Anything less than that, why tell them almost to that point? So that was about, you know, finding out what the state of the art was in terms of the science. Second, beginning to build a construct of an education program. So when people did hear these warnings, they knew what to do. And third, develop the warning systems that would actually alert them within that time frame. So it's a pretty big formula and a pretty big mission with zero resources. We weren't allocated any funding to do it, so we did what we could. More must be done.
In a state that is so heavily dependent on the visitor industry, there's a lot of incentive not to alarm people. How much does that get in the way?
Oh, I don't know if it gets in the way, but it certainly contributes to the design of the program. I mean, we could have poured enormous resources and time into educating the public, but the risk there is that you could create a concern on the part of the visitor industry on how safe is Hawaii. And that could hurt us. You know, we could see visitor numbers fall, and we could see the economic consequences of that. That's not where we wanted to go. So we had to do this with great patience and finesse to start moving forward without triggering the immune system on the visitor mm-hmm. industry. And fortunately, during the whole period of development, visitor numbers actually went up. They didn't go down. By contrast, our colleagues on Guam, when North Korea was threatening Guam, they saw somewhere between 15 and 25% reduction in their visitors. And that had a substantial economic impact on the territory. So we do not want to go down that road. So it's a balancing act, preparing the public, educating them, and not alarming the visitor industry.
And Guam gets most of its visitors from Japan, whereas I think maybe here in Hawaii, we at least have more of the folks coming from the mainland, Canada, you know, and other places. But certainly, Japan has its history with nuclear weapons as well. So understandably, they stayed away.
Yeah, and they do. But the other thing about Japan that you got to remember is that Japan is facing this threat just like we are. In fact, their launch to impact time is shorter. They regularly do drills. I mean, it's becoming the trick to preparedness is to weave it into the fabric of the way you live your life. So that it's not something that you do once a year like Fire Safety Week. It's something that you think about every day. You know, when I was in the profession, as you know, I retired this last month. I woke up every morning thinking today could be the day. And it's not about the alert system that went off. It was about today could be the day a plane crashes. Today is a day a tsunami could make landfall. You know, these things. And you have to be thinking about how your day is going to run and what you're going to do. We all need to think of that a little bit. But it's hard to do that when you're living your life, getting the kids to school and going to your job and, you know, getting the car fixed. Those things get in the way of thinking about preparedness. So we have to weave it in, and we haven't done that successfully yet.
We talked to a couple of emergency management experts who mentioned that their initial reaction was to look at the process as opposed to, you know, assigning blame. Is it what failed in the process?
Well, I think if you look at the root cause, it's asking an organization, a good organization, the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency is a good organization with good people, to do things only an excellent organization should do. So there's a big difference between HAIMA and NASA. So if you wanted a level of reliability up with the big players, then you need to resource them in other words, build the systems and processes and things that, that ensure that it does behave that way. So, you know, if you want an absolute certainty that no error will ever occur, that everyone will do the right thing at the right time for the right reason, then you need to build it that way. So Haima needs help. And so when you ask about the report, I'm hoping the report will begin to create a future that looks more like an excellent organization where the people at Haima have what they need when they need it to do the job well.
And folks might want to know, why did you step down? Why did you retire at this time? You say it's a good agency, but people might want to know that.
I think it was a number of factors, not just one. The Star Advertiser liked to sort of pick on one. I had planned to leave at the end of the year, which was the end of the governor's term. And this event, just the future, the next few months, just looked to be very tumultuous. I thought it was likely that my boss was going to leave. And I came to the agency because of Vern Miyagi. I wanted to work with him. He's an extraordinary man. And I sensed that he would probably be asked to leave. Once the blame game started, they were looking for who did this and when, I felt it was time to step away, and I did.
Toby, were you to, in a perfect world, be told, what resources do you need? Here's funding. What would be your druthers to make the changes you'd like to see made?
Well, I have a background in engineering and healthcare, and when we look at critical systems, there's a couple of modes of design and response that you need to consider. So one would be to apply a more engineering approach to this, and that's called a failure modes effects analysis. In other words, look at what you want to do, and then look at everything it takes to do that really well. And then look at possible avenues of error. You know, could this happen? Could that happen? They do that when they design aircraft. Mm-hmm. That's why you see so few plane crashes as a result of mechanical failure. Most of them today are the result of weather or pilot error. And then when you do have an incident, even if it's a small one, you do a root cause analysis so you completely understand all the things it takes, the full spectrum of things it takes to prevent it the next time. And I'm not sure that was done with the first report. And remember, the first report was really looking at the event mm-hmm. and what information they had at the time. So it was fairly superficial. It's as good as you could do in, 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah.
Hopefully we'll dig deeper and find out. Because if we do find out, we'll find the truth. And the truth isn't that somebody did something wrong. It's mostly about the way the organization is designed and resourced.
And you mentioned that you did get a chance to talk to the employee, the so-called button pusher. I know there are folks in the investigation, they said they didn't get a chance to. Can you share anything at all about what he might have told you?
A little bit. I realize he's represented by counsel now, and I don't want to interfere with his that whole process. This event caught me with my pants down, quite literally. I was in the shower at home when it happened. But as soon as I could, I dashed off to Diamond Head and was there within 90 minutes or so. So I had an opportunity to briefly speak with the individual and the people around them. Just what happened? What's going on? And I really do believe he believes that that this event was real. We've been drilling and training within the context that I mentioned. And I really do think he believed it. I don't think he did this out of negligence or because he didn't care. I don't know anybody at Haima, anybody, right down to the janitors and everyone else, that don't fully believe that their job is to protect the people of Hawaii. That includes this individual. So he told me a little bit. He didn't write a statement for a couple days. Nobody asked him, from what I understand, officially. But his story's coming out. I think he spoke very honestly when he was interviewed recently.
Toby Claremont is a retired executive officer for the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. This is The Conversation, and today's program is a panel discussion of emergency preparedness in Hawaii.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us on today's panel are HPR's News Director Bill Dorman, along with Courtney Harrington, the chair of the State Emergency Communications Committee. This is a FCC-appointed position. Now, the committee writes and oversees the plan for coordinating the use of the EAS system by Hawaii broadcasters. Harrington is also director of the EAS system here in the islands. Jo LaFleur is a former FEMA executive who also served as Emergency Services Director of two states and is now with GP Strategies Corporate Crisis Program. He joins us by a phone from Maryland.
Welcome to them. And as we continue to learn from the January 13th missile threat, our awareness of the state's disaster planning has been greatly heightened. We're asking listeners to share their stories and ask their questions. The numbers to call are 941-3689, 877-941-3689 from Neighbor Islands.
Courtney, why don't we start with you? You heard Toby. Do you agree with his assessment that we've just been complacent?
Everything. Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I would call it benign neglect more than anything else. You know, this is interesting in that this is the first short fuse type of emergency we've ever had. We've always had the opportunity for a 72-hour notice with a hurricane, or if you're looking at a tsunami, 4, 6, 12 hours away. There's plenty of time to get the word out. There's plenty of time for people to decide, okay, what I'm going to do, get home, get their kids, whatever. We have been blessed. We've been very lucky we have not had a short fuse, because you could have a plane crashing downtown. You could have a tanker exploding offshore. You have radiological and biological events that could happen. And I think nobody was ready for it. And there's some systemic problems, as Toby was saying. When you set up a plan to do something, just like engineering, you have to sit down and say, okay, what can go wrong?
Right.
And, you know, what do I do to mitigate that? You always have to have a plan B. And somewhere along the line, at least on the EAS system at the state side, nobody, and it's obvious they've admitted it, nobody sat down and said, well, what do we screw up? How do we cancel it? And from what I have heard about their menu, particular menu system, it's just as terrible and confusing. And I think my concern, one that the broadcasters are mostly unhappy about, is the lack of communication.
Mm-hmm.
When you have 72-hour notice for a hurricane or whatever, there is a lot of time for communication. There's time for the state and the National Weather Service to hold press conferences. There's time to do interviews, get the word out. When you have a short fuse like this, people turn to government. What do I do? And government wasn't talking. They were too busy figuring out, how am I going to tell everybody this isn't real? And that's a terrible problem. And this is part of the emergency alert system plan. This is an agreement, if you will, between the state and the 100 broadcasters in the state of Hawaii on how we are going to communicate together. The emergency alert system, which is an outgrowth of the old emergency broadcast system, was put in and ordered to be installed in every radio and TV and cable in the country so the White House could talk to the population if necessary. Thank goodness that doesn't happen very, very much. So what FEMA and the Federal Communications Commission then did, said, well, let's allow local authorities to use it because they have floods and they have, sure, you know, tornadoes and all kinds of things, and what a great way to get the word out to them. That is voluntary, and a lot of people don't understand that. The White House talking to the population is mandatory, but for local authorities to do it is all based upon the cooperation of the broadcasters. And it should be clear, the broadcasters want to help. Nobody's ever said to me, oh, I don't want to do this. What I hear from them is I'm not getting enough information. Nobody's telling us what's going on. And when you stop and you think about this, to me, this is an extremely important issue. Emergencies don't happen at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon,
right,
where everybody's in the office. They happen at 1 a.m. on a Sunday, where you usually have one guy there, mm-hmm, or nobody because they're playing tapes or satellite feeds. You're leaving the emergency in the hands of the people who are least prepared to deal with it. The emergency alert system is exactly that. It's an alert system. It's a Twitter for radio and TV. You only send out 90 characters, which is enough time to say, we got a problem, folks. And for 40 or 50 years here in Hawaii, we have been educating people that if there is a problem, if you hear the sirens go off, whatever, tune in your radio. And I think that's where they really fell down. And that is the focus of what we're working on right now. We need to get some policies and some procedures in that if what we call the balloon goes up for any particular reason, there are staff available to get the word out, to pick up the phone and call the major radio stations and say, here's what's going on, here's what we recommend you do, and to be available. Because it takes a while, and Kathy, you know this coming from TV, it takes a while to gear up.
Yep.
You know, radio stations is a little bit different thing. They can do everything by telephone or they're in the studio already. But the time you get everybody out of bed and TV, you know, and get dressed and come on in, figure out what's going on, and send the crews out.
You're a 20-minute window, Courtney.
Yeah, we got a 20-minute window, and you got a 2 hours of trying to get people in the field. So radio is primary. TV doesn't like to hear that, but radio is the primary. And while I applaud people like Gabbert and the rest of them saying, well, I got to do something, I'll put it on Facebook or Twitter, that didn't get to very many people.
Right, and Hawaii is not the only one that's in this situation. Mm-hmm. The whole country is. And Joe LaFleur, you've worked at two different emergency agencies for two different states. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that this has really shaken up the entire country, and so I appreciate the invitation to be in on the dialogue with you, and I think Courtney did an excellent job of recounting not only the foundation of the warning program, but also issues that continue to plague it in different parts of the country. I also have a non-political position on the Maryland Governor's Emergency Management Advisory Committee, and I can tell you that the governor's office had immediate questions to the emergency management agency within hours after the Hawaii situation, and they were doing a deep dive on their procedures to see if, in fact, they were in good shape, if you will, and didn't have some of the system issues that have been uncovered in Hawaii. So there is a National Emergency Management Association meeting. That's an annual or semi-annual meeting of the 50 state emergency management directors in March in Washington, D.C., and I can assure you that this will be a topic in one of, if not on their general session, it will be in their preparedness committee. So you've gained an awful lot of attention, and I think there are some additional things in terms of emergency management practices that can be done as well.
We've got a caller on the line from Hawaii Kai. Richard, what you're calling about sounds like it flows pretty well out of what Joe was just saying. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Like many people, I had been awake very short time when I got the alert on my phone. I noticed the sirens weren't going. I think it was a great wake-up call for individuals and for everybody. But, you know, I thought, okay, what I'll do, like your previous colleague said, was I'll listen to the radio. And, of course, I tuned into Hawaii Public Radio. And I don't understand why Hawaii Public Radio didn't comment on it for so long, about a half an hour. I ended up flipping through radio stations, and I heard from a pop radio station DJ that it had been tweeted by our senators that it was a mistake. And I don't understand why Hawaii Public Radio, was there anyone working? What can Hawaii Public Radio do next time?
Bill Dorman, our news director, is with us in the studio. Bill?
Hi, and thanks, Richard. It's a great question, and it is. We have taken a look at what we did and what we can do next time. The short answer at the moment when that happened, Courtney, this goes back in some ways to trust. What happened was an emergency alert went out by mobile phones. The system itself did not engage to us. The sirens did not go off. In retrospect, and we did have someone here live. We are staffed 24 hours, 7 days a week. And in retrospect, what we should have, might have done and will do next time is to say, this is what's going on. This went off on an emergency alert system, but we have not heard the sirens. We have not gotten confirmation through other means, and we are working to find out what is there. At the time, it was a matter of trying to confirm information, and that's back to the point in terms of trying to get in touch with folks. Phone lines, of course, jammed at that point, and it took time to be able to get through to do that.
You know, the most common question I got in the days following January 13th from news organizations and broadcasters, well, how can we verify this?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is, you can't. You have to go on trust.
You got
a missile coming in, and it's 20 minutes away.
But you have contradictory information in terms of an alert system coming in to tell you that this is happening or this is not happening. And then do you add to confusion for the public by broadcasting that, or what is that coming down to?
And this goes right back to what I was saying before, that there are two legs that emergency management or the old civil defense has to stand on. One is the fact that you prepare for an emergency or a disaster. You sit there and you ballpark all day long and you come up with plans. And no matter how strange they may be, just because of that strange things happen, you've given it some thought somewhere along the line. During an emergency, there's no time to try and figure what to do. Now, of course, the military says, and they're absolutely correct, no plan ever survives execution. It doesn't, because everything's different on it. But at least you have a roadmap of what you need to do so you don't forget it. What in this particular type of situation, they completely forgot the other leg, which is you've got to tell people what's going on. And there was really no communication that amounted to anything. And it's nice that Senator Gabbard put up something on Facebook and Twitter, but when it's all over, who is she? See, this lies the problem in everybody's mind. We have a crisis of confidence. And the next time one of these goes out, a significant portion of the broadcasters, the public, in my mind, are going to say, is this for real? When they should be doing something about it. So there's a lot that needs to be repaired here. And this is like a marriage that's gone bad. This isn't something that's just you're gonna fix some stuff and you can come up with some plans and procedures and everything is hunky dory. There's an old saying, you can fix a crack in a dam, but people are gonna keep an eye on it for a long, long time. And that's the issue we have right here. And I think my disappointment, and I totally back up Toby Claremont on this, that they are good people. They're well-intentioned people. They're intelligent people. They're well-trained up there. There are some problems. But when I bring these issues up to the people up there, when we're talking about it, I see the eyes glaze over in many cases. Nobody's dealing with it. And what I also found, I think it bothered me, that General Olivera or General Hara or any of the other people who were doing an investigation never talked to us. We were never invited to be a part of saying, here's what's happening outside the door. And as Toby says, the concern is that you find out what the problem is and you fix the problem, but you're so focused on that the other issues that January 13th pointed out to everybody are not being addressed right now.
Catherine talked earlier with Carl Kim, who was the executive director of the National Disaster Preparedness Training Center. He was chair of the National Domestic Preparedness Consortium, currently a professor at the UH Department of Urban and Regional Planning. The center gets its funding from FEMA and Homeland Security, and he says more attention needs to be paid to the ways people are getting the message.
The biggest challenge is that there are multiple sources of information. In the old days, it was TV, radio, that was the credible, go-to source. But now we have, text messages, we have, all these different social media sources, and they're all coming out at the same time or close to the same time. And, how do you trust that information? And so that's part of the research that we've been doing at the University of Hawaii to study these different channels, these different, you know, conduits for information, and what information do you trust, and how do you validate this information? But we're sort of in this new world because this is all emerging technology and, you know, different systems that exist. And so, and remember, it's not just government or the emergency management agency that's responsible for this. It's the media. It's also individuals. It's bloggers. It's, you know, everyone else that's out there. And so that's what makes this the complex world that we live in now. And so I think, I mean, one of the big takeaways is that we do have to understand better how to use this technology, all of these technologies, to better coordinate information sources, and then also how do we validate this information and what is the credible source? And if you hear it from one source, how do you check on this?
We've also got Joe LaFleur, who has been emergency services director in two states. Joe, did you hear what that caller just said? Are you what Carl Kim just said? Are you in agreement with that?
Well, yes, I am. On when you get to that point downstream, I think that's a very critical issue of both trust and information sharing. And I want to take it one step back before that. I think you've hit on a real pivot point in the whole discussion. Verification won't happen, as Courtney said earlier also, where 25 radio stations or four television stations can call in and get verification. They've got to go on trust. But what I didn't see in any of the reports so far, and I read the January 29th report, et cetera, was the issue of how the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency was drilling these activities. And specifically what I'll point out is when you have something, any kind of an emergency, but particularly one like this that you can pre-script the warning for, I didn't see in any of the discussion that there would have been the return call to PACOM or FEMA or whoever their notifying body was. I'm calling you back. Was that a valid message? Because as we all know today, and we've seen it in our national and international events, and I won't recover those for any political purposes, but if you don't call back and verify, then you trigger immediately an alert, and that wasn't in their procedures, at least not outlined in the reports, that is a misstep. And I can tell you that, at least on the mainland where there are many nuclear power plants, that is a critical step in when you test and when you exercise on things that might lead to an immediate evacuation or a very near-term evacuation or people moving to shelters, whatever the case might be. So there's the verification step. Now, if all that was outlined, and there ought to be maybe a big broadcasters meeting out there like Courtney's talking about, you would talk about the verification and how Hawaii wants to do that so that you build up that trust level that in the future we're going to be getting a verified message, and it's going to be sound in every step all the way down the line. So I think that's number one. A second point I want to make is these kinds of drills can get to be very routine. And given the reports that have come out and the comments in the interviews, you can see that maybe there wasn't the level of intensity. And I don't know how they're evaluating their exercises and drills. And these are relatively short-term drills like this one, but how much the serious nature of it is if it goes awry, that if you don't have an evaluator there, then you shouldn't, then how come you weren't picking up perhaps some personnel issues in the people who were conducting the activities and carrying them out? So it's not just root cause analysis, but it's how are you overseeing the process as well?
And you just referred to verification, and Bill, that's kind of what you were just talking about in terms of, you know, the importance to us as communicators of not proceeding without verification.
But understanding also that in this case that there's no time for that. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if the message is trust us, but without that circle back ability, that was an excellent point as well.
And I know, Courtney, you had mentioned that in this day and age, a lot of broadcasters are not staffed 24 hours a day like they used to be when we started, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's different. So you've got folks that are getting their message from, you know, different ways, right?
Yeah, and there's a part of the old emergency broadcast system we're looking at because part of it is still actually in place, though not really used. Back 15, 20 years ago, there was a dedicated phone line to every major broadcast station. And when I used this at Nike and also Hurricane Eva, that when we activated the emergency broadcast system, a red light went on in every studio. And what they did is, on their control console, they had a little volume control there, and they could put it in a position called Q, and the guy on the air would be able to listen what's coming down the line, and they would hear someone like me saying, you know, this is the Wahoo Civil Defense. We have a emergency message. We carry it 60 seconds, and then we start a countdown at 10, and bam, we're on the air. These phone lines are still pretty much in place, so they need to be upgraded. There's also what we call an RPU, a radio system, a very good one that could be used for backup. We can communicate to the public. That just needs to be some procedures in there that says you've got to do this and do it, you know, number two on your list. So all of this is there. It's a complex issue we're looking at. It's not a simple thing as some guy misheard something and went and decided to push a button. There's a lot of dynamics in here, you know, and I talk to people all the time, and they're angry, and they have every right to be angry, and why can't you fix it today? Well, there's more than today involved, unfortunately. When you start looking at all the various dynamics and permutations that need to be addressed now, you have one opportunity, a great one, to fix it. So let's do it. Let's do it correctly.
There's a caller on the line, Art from Makiki. Art?
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
You know, assuming that this alert system is going to be improved, the question is, when you're told to take cover, where do you go? In 20 minutes, you have maybe enough time to call your loved one and then kiss yourself goodbye. I mean, we have no designated shelters, much less shelters stocked with food, water, medical supplies, and so forth. So,
assuming
the system is improved, now I'm going to be told, okay, you're about to die in 20 minutes. So is that really
Art, this is Courtney Harrington. First of all, the shelters in Hawaii are designed to provide a roof and a dry place for you to stay. And that's why they say bring your medication, bring some food, bring whatever you have, because these are schools, and there's just no place to put that stuff. The other thing is there is a responsibility that you have, that everybody has, that you have to think about, what am I going to do? Government can't sit there and say, okay, we think we have a missile coming in. This is what you got to do. It depends on where you live. It depends on whether there's a mountain between you and the potential target, how big your house is, how sturdy your house is, where your kids are. There's a lot of things that you have to think about yourself, and so that if something like this happens again, whether it's a tsunami or whatever short fuse, you got some idea what to do and where to go. And we just can't tell you that because it's just too many variables. That's not saying they should have done more. They should have. But at the same time, ultimately you're responsible for yourself and your family. You need to give it some thought.
Art, are you still on the line?
I'm still on the line.
What's your response to that?
My response is that the government has no responsibility. We're on our own. Basically, that's what I hear.
No, well, I think you're hearing, you know, what you came on the phone with. What would you expect government to do? And I'm asking you because I really want to know. If there's a 20-minute short fuse, what do you want to hear from government?
What did we do when we had a higher level of nuclear attack when we were during the Cold War? Weren't there shelters designated and so forth and so on? Aren't there better places than my ranch house that just blown to the ground by a nuclear bomb?
Oh, I mean, you know. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't have bomb shelters anymore. You know, there's some, you can go to New York and walk down the street and you'll see the fallout shelters all rusty hanging there. but there's nothing in it, and the food's never been replaced. And this is a national issue that needs to be dealt with. Here in Hawaii, our shelters are predominantly the schools, because this is the only place that's big enough. There's just really no room to be stocking cots and food and everything else. But this is a question Toby Claremont could really answer, because he's been deeply involved in. But ultimately, again, you grab what you can. This is why everybody tells you have 2 weeks worth of food and all your medicines and everything ready, because if something happens, and Toby mentioned this, it could be hours or days. I personally think it's going to be more. If we have a major disaster here, you are assuming that the airport is open, and you're assuming that the harbor is operational. If it is not, it's going to be much longer than days.
And Toby did share with me that one of the things they were talking about is that, a short message: get inside, stay tuned. I was on a beach. I would have not had time to jump in my car and go home. And so I said, what's the nearest shelter? Is it the Natatorium or is it Kaimana Beach Hotel? And that's where I went, was I went to the hotel because I wanted to know what they were telling the guests. So, you don't have much time. Get inside, stay tuned.
But anyway, Art, I understand I understand where you're coming from. I hear your frustration. This is something that needs to be dealt with, whether it's better educational process or going back to what's been my mantra, we need to have the officials communicate with the public better. In fact, we need to get them to communicate at all during something like this.
Courtney, there's a caller on the line, Peter from Hawaii Kai. Peter, you were asking about 911. What was your question?
Well, it dawned on me that when 911 was jammed, if we had a real emergency like a fire, heart attacks, serious accidents, how would we get services? And is the state addressing this potential problem?
I don't know if it's addressable. And let me explain that. We have a unique thing here in Hawaii, and maybe it's U.S.-wide. When we get an alert of some sort, be it a tsunami or a hurricane or whatever, everybody gets on the phone, and they call up Auntie. Did you hear there's a hurricane coming?
Yep.
And the phone system crumbles. And, you can build a phone system that would be able to sustain itself during these peaks, but you probably wouldn't be able to afford to use it because of all that extra equipment just sitting there doing nothing. That's a problem, and that's part of what we've moved into as a society. You can't go to a website. A lot of people tried to go up to the state's website, find out what's going on. Well, that crashed because everybody else was doing it. We go back again, and I'm sounding like a broken record here, but I'm going to keep beating on this until the lights go on in some people's eyes. You have to go back to the broadcasters. They're the only ones that are going to be able to communicate with the people and tell them what to do. It just isn't going to work any other way. And people go to the radios, they're in their car, they're rushing to school to get their kids, they're not watching TV, they're not getting on Twitter, they're looking for somebody, somewhere, say, what do I do? And that's the fail right there. And that's what is going to be addressed if it's the last thing I do on this committee.
And as Courtney Herring, who's referring to, he's the chair of the State Emergency Communications Committee. Our subject is disaster preparedness in the wake of January 13th. Joe LaFleur, a former FEMA executive, emergency services director of two states, has been emergency services director of two states. Those are our panelists, and we're running out of time, but we're still, still got a few minutes to address that subject. Numbers are 941-3689, 877-941-3689. With just a few minutes left to address some of your concerns.
Chris, also talking about making adjustments, and Courtney, you mentioned on the communication system that goes through. Mm-hmm. We have now, for example, at Hawaii Public Radio, re-looked at what we do with automatic alerts going straight to air as opposed to delays. We've made some adjustments on those different warning systems. But also, this warning that went out under an unfamiliar coding, too many. So that is, again, in terms of for our listeners who are wondering, is there something that has changed or is changing in terms of the communication, that certainly has changed already.
There was really no code for an incoming missile, so they kind of snuck it out under a civil emergency code.
And without sort of, again, letting broadcasters know that, by the way, this is what we're going to do, and coming back to communication and ultimately to trust.
This is the system breaking down. When you send out an alert, and let me talk about the recall because that's what's really got most people upset. When you send out an alert and then you find out you do not have a code because you didn't think about it to recall any of this information, you come up with, what can I use? When these messages are constructed, they have a code at the beginning of them. And when the digital message goes out, the decoder in the various broadcast stations look for different codes on it. And some that you have set up automatically go to air. And so they looked for one that already was on the system that hopefully most people had set. Again, it's voluntary to go forward. And that's why there were some problems with some people getting it, some don't. People also don't understand, you know, that we're such a cell phone-based society right now that you can turn those alerts off on your cell phone. You can turn off the Amber alerts, and you can turn off the state and local alerts. Once you can't turn off the federal, so a lot of people turned off because it's starting to bug them after a while, and that's why you wouldn't get it on your phone. And the way the phone system is set up, the wireless emergency alert, it blasts out to everybody.
Different, and the wireless alert is different than the system that you're talking about.
It's an adjunct to it,
but it's different. To be fair,
it's different. Yeah, and I think the thing that we need to understand is the emergency alert system, the wireless alert system, they worked exactly as designed. That's the way they were designed, and they worked. It was garbage in, garbage out is what happened. Somebody, you know, did something wrong, and it took that wrong, and the equipment's not going to sit there and say, well, is this right? Should I verify it? If somebody in a position of authority sets the right code, pushes the right button, the system sent it out.
We were told this morning by Toby Claremont that the software system that they had in place was only in place for about a month. We were told that there was an older system that was kind of failing, that it took like 5 minutes to load up. And so they went to this new software and probably weren't familiar with the screen and the system that was in place to put out the drill.
And, you know, I mean, a month is plenty of time to get used to something because if you've got a checklist there. Pilots use them. Everybody uses them. What am I supposed to do? Step one, step two, step three. There's more than one person there. The guy that pushes the buttons for the siren knew this wasn't real. So the sirens never went off. I keep hearing about this menu system, and I haven't seen it. But from the descriptions and from some of the pictures that have been released by the Emergency Management Agency, I want to put a gun in my head and shoot it. You know, I've never seen anything so poorly designed in my life. Now, whose fault is that? That's the fault of the vendor. There are best practices. You look at the military. The military has been playing with very dangerous toys for a whole lot of years, and they've got some very good systems in place to make sure they don't do something like this. And that all starts with designing your computers that you're looking at.
Right, and so hopefully we'll hear more about that in General Haro's report. Addressing the software failures, whether it was the best system we could have had in place or whether we need to put more money into it to get a better system.
My guess is it was a good system. It just had a very poorly designed menu system. And then he pointed to two people. How could a vendor charging so much money do something that bad when it's against all best practices? And then I have to point fingers also at the state saying, did anybody look at this and say, what the heck is, you know, let's fix this.
We talked to the person referred to in the January 29th report as employee number one. Let's just hear a quick excerpt of what he said to us.
And the drills up to that point in the month or two before that, they were were usually errors and mistakes by the workers. I mean, it's a learning process, of course, but the procedures and processes were always changing also.
That was part of a discussion we had that about the kind of drills that precede a major drill like this. And of course, the employee number one is essentially saying that he had been set up and was ill-prepared by the way the alert came down. We're only about a minute or so away from having to end this particular panel, but final thoughts, Courtney?
I think we're moving forward. I don't think, you know, people realize what's going on, and they're getting a little frustrated. You know, why aren't there some answers? Why don't I see anything? It's a complex issue, and that sounds like a bureaucratic answer, but the more we dealt into it, the more complex it became. A lot of moving parts. We had to go out to all 100 radio and TV stations to find out, okay, did you get the warning? Did you pass it on? And then, of course, like herding cats trying to get people to answer. But until you have all of these facts, it's difficult to say, okay, here's the problem we got. Let's address it now.
Well, we'll look ahead to that, Catherine. We'll look ahead to that report we're expecting, which is now due next week. Courtney Harrington, whose voice you just heard, is the chair of the State Emergency Communications Committee. Joining us from Maryland by phone has been Joe LaFleur, a former FEMA executive who has been emergency services director of two states. Bill Dorman, our news director, has been with us in our studio. We've had several calls. We've had some calls we weren't able to respond to right away. We will address those through our talkback line. But we want to thank our callers for calling in and thank our panel for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Monday is President's Day, so join us on Tuesday for more of The Conversation.
And if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact that talkback line even after the show's over. Leave us your comments. That number is a different one, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And our show is podcasted at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.